Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Coffee Talk. Good afternoon, and welcome, and thank you for listening to this great show. I am here with my colleague, Michael Lumbers. Michael?
Fadi, could it be that the NATO Association of Canada's most popular podcast is back so soon with another edition?
Yes, we are. Summer's over. We're back in the office. We're recording these things.
Exactly. You know, Fadi, I came here today to do two things.
And what are those?
To chew bubblegum and talk. And you know what? I'm all out of bubblegum. So let's talk.
Let's talk then. We're here again with Emerson Murray, whose article is inspiring this episode. Emerson, can you please let us know a bit about the article?
Well, I'm actually just finishing up an article about the gun rights versus gun control debate that has been raging in the U.S. for I don't even know how many decades. It's inspired more so just by my sort of interest in racial politics in the U.S. And actually, I am tying how race shapes both the politics of gun rights and gun control in very profound ways. So I essentially go through the history, first of all, of the Second Amendment, and the context in which the right to bear arms and have a well-ordered militia came about, looking at how that has a very racialized dimension and pulling through to understand, even in the post-slavery context, the ways in which whites and blacks have been entitled to the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, in very different ways. And in understanding this, you know, I hope that we can sort of understand the way that sort of this debate today is shaped by race, and perhaps it will allow, you know, for it to go forward. And I'm not really, I mean, saying anything myself that is profoundly original. It's just, you know, sort of a condensed take that, you know, readers can digest. And,
so how is it affected by race, then, this debate?
Well, if you start, let's start looking at, you know, what are gun rights? Why do we have them? Who do they serve? So the common logic goes is that, you know, gun rights are there for, you know, protection against tyrannical governments. You know, they were introduced in the American Revolutionary context, you know, for civilian militias to be able to resist British imperial rule, and also, you know, the potential for tyranny to arise in the federal government. But when you actually look at different legal scholarship and different legal interpretations, a notable one is that by Carl Bogus. It was actually a compromise. It was a compromise that was made to assure the southern slave states that the federal government, at the time of the writing of the Constitution and the creation of the Bill of Rights, that they would not undermine the slave system. And that's because at the time, civilian militias were synonymous with slave patrols in the American South.
So it's essentially economic reasons.
Mm-hmm. So we had, you know, militias, first of all, at, you know, initial settler colonization, they're used to fend off indigenous resistance. And then afterwards, once the political economy, you know, was restructured, you had the, you know, the slave system, these armed patrols of white men, you know, based on the communities, were used to essentially reinforce the slave system. And it was at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, that's, you know, where Carl Bogus does his main analysis, is where the fears are played upon, is that, you know, in trying to ratify the Constitution, you know, Article 1, Section 8 of it says that Congress has the ability to arm the militia. And so they're worried that the Congress could eventually use its constitutional powers if, for example, Northern abolitionists ever got control of it to disarm the militia, which was the key, you know, tool of slave control. And slavery was so integral to the political economy of the Southern states at that time. That is where, you know, the underlying motivations come in. That's why, you know, we believe that the Second Amendment, the right, so the right to bear arms to well-ordered militia, you know, that is why we believe that was added to the Bill of Rights in 1789.
Do you see, in terms of the arguments that are put forth today by gun rights advocates, do you see any recognition of the historical origins of the Second Amendment?
Yes, but in a way that sort of reinforces the legitimacy of gun rights in their eyes.
Essentially,
and I'll actually touch upon
their purposes.
That later.
Yeah.
Adam Winkler, who is very much an expert within sort of the politics of guns, he has widely published books, published many online articles, actually notes, you know, that the NRA on its website, I don't know if it's sure the NRA or its sort of branch, lobbying branch, the Institute for Legislative Action.
For our many listeners who don't know what the NRA is, that's the National
Rifle
Association.
It actually has published essays called The Racist Roots of Gun Control, which I will touch upon later. That, you know, those sorts of arguments are sort of misconstrued as to put forth an argument for gun rights that sort of ignores, first of all, historical context and the modern context in which, gun violence takes place and is racialized. So once slavery finished, it then followed that white militias, the free blacks, so the newly free black slaves actually had access to weapons, from the underground market, and for those who were fighting as part of the unionists, they actually had access to weapons, but instead of being able to enjoy their freedoms, many of the southern slave states started to pass black codes. So these were primarily to prevent blacks from joining the labor market to any meaningful extent, but also there are restrictions on gun ownership, possession, and use. And white militias in various states, the most famous of which is the KKK, would go out at night not only to conduct mob lynchings of blacks, but to go after those weapons that they acquired because, that was a way to reinforce white supremacist control in the post-slavery era.
For our many listeners who don't know what the KKK is, that is the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes. And even then, so the Second Amendment, the way it is enforced, has never been done so equally between whites and blacks. And for most of history, actually up until the 1970s, the National Rifle Association endorsed gun control. It signed the first federal restrictions on gun ownership in the 1930s, the late 1930s, and did so in many states, or helped draft and help sign these in the 1920s. And part of this was due to fear about black resistance. So during the civil rights era, you had white fears of the Black Panthers, black power, and also urban race riots that were going on in the late 60s. 1960s.
Yeah. Particularly,
yeah.
Most notably, L.A.,
yeah.
Newark, Detroit.
And actually, Ronald Reagan signed the first state-level ban on, it was open carry, the open carry ban in 1967, after the Black Panthers, 30 of them actually walked into the California state legislature and protested a impending gun control bill, the Mulford Act, which then motivated Ronald Reagan to go forth and sign it.
One of many examples, I may interject, one of many examples where Ronald Reagan's somewhat moderate record, but belies the hero worship that's foisted on him by the most fervent right-wing Republicans today. That was an interesting,
yeah.
It's another example.
Yeah. So you can see how, within this context, so throughout history from the 1970s, gun rights, gun control have very racist aspects to them. Gun rights, insofar as it was used to reinforce the slave system. Gun control, as it was to quell black resistance. And eventually to take away the last defense that many blacks had against white supremacist violence throughout U.S. history. This shift then happened in 1977 with a leadership coup within the National Rifle Association, driven by its libertarian wing.
Mm.
This libertarian wing notably aligned itself with the New Right Coalition that brought Ronald Reagan to power,
right,
but was also inspired by white resistance to the civil rights movement and desegregation in the 1950s and 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was brought up in a couple of the sources that I came across. In the George Wallace movement, if you're familiar with that.
Of course.
Yeah. And so at this point, this is when the NRA...
For those of our listeners
yeah.
who don't know who George Wallace is, he was the governor of Alabama, a fervent segregationist, and he ran as a third-party candidate in the 1968
yes.
presidential election.
Yeah. And so we have the switch over, and the discourse with which the NRA began to promote gun rights rather than gun control played again upon white fears, however, of the criminality of black people. So we need to have law-abiding citizens be able to defend themselves, their family, their property against criminals. But racially coded to understand law-abiding citizens were whites, those criminals were black. And that sort of mentality continues today. And today, you know, gun violence has very racialized outcomes. I was found in 2014, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention found that black people were 21 times more likely to die of gun violence than whites in 2014. And,
which I believe.
You know, when you look at public opinion today on whether gun control or gun rights should be prioritized, this was done by the Pew Research Center. It was something like almost 60% of white Americans saw gun rights as more important than gun control. 75% or near that of blacks saw the reverse.
Yeah,
and
I'm not surprised
by
that. Yeah.
And when you look at, you know, not only how, you know, how much the greater risk of being killed by a gun homicide is for blacks, it's also the fact that when you look at the deaths, you know, the proportions of which were homicides versus suicides, it's like 83% of white deaths by gun violence were suicides.
Okay.
And it's almost the total reverse figure for black Americans, which were homicides.
Right, right.
And so when you look at, you know, the case for doing something about this gun situation, especially considering, you know, how much communities of color are afflicted by gun violence and the mass shootings that have taken place recently, for example, Orlando, and even before that, San Bernardino, you know, the movie theater in Colorado, Sandy Hook. You know, I think you have a very strong case to push for some sort of change to the status quo when you look at the racialized dimension.
Sure.
But when you consider the racialized history of gun control, how it has been used for racist purposes, that complicates things. And also because if, you know, in states that do actually have gun restrictions, for example, in New York, stop and frisk policies disproportionately target blacks, Latinos. Something like, you know, almost 80% of people stopped and frisked in 2015 were people of color in New York City. And those are stops done in pedestrians to look for weapons and contraband. And so that's why organizations such as Black Lives Matter have been hesitant to endorse conventional gun reforms like those that were pushed in the aftermath of Orlando.
Right.
Shooting with, you know, the filibuster and the sit-in by the Democrats in both the House and the Senate.
Or the stuff that would happen, you know, the failure of the gun control policies after Sandy Hook, essentially.
So, I mean, I'm not really here to come forward with the solution. Like, how do you, you know, address gun violence without engaging in racial profiling? Or also feeding into mass incarceration that you have going on in the U.S. today with, I think, you know, blacks and Latinos make up together maybe 30%, quarter of the U.S. population, but are 58% of incarcerees. And in at the state level, you know, a black person is 5 times more likely than a white person to go to jail. And in 5 states, if I remember correctly, it's like New Jersey, Wisconsin, Iowa, Vermont, and Minnesota. That goes up to 10 times. A very, you know, racist criminal justice system. And anti-racist groups, even if they consider, you know, how gun violence disproportionately affects communities of color, are going to be hesitant to endorse conventional gun reforms that you see on the table today.
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to gun control in the United States, and not to, you know, make light of the situation, but the first thing that I think of is Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore's movie from a number of years ago, where he begins with the Columbine shooting. And how, you know, essentially disenchanted youth, you know, managed to buy weapons without any problems and shooting at people. And he compares, you know, this, you know, the policies and the laws in the States and the way you would buy ammunitions and guns with that in Canada. Because I think it's an interesting comparison because we still do have people that hunt and fish and use guns. And I must admit, on a side note, I did live in Northern Ontario and I did work in some sort of political in politics at the time. And I recall gun control and gun issues were some of the top spoken about issues at the doors when election campaigns were happening, especially at the federal level. And if you recall, Stephen Harper's push to deregulate gun control and to deregulate guns in his right-wing approach to
the gun registry,
yeah. and other. And ultimately speaking, we have laws against guns in Canada. Mm. They are a bit tighter than those in the United States, but there is a cultural difference which comes to the root of what Emerson is speaking about today. We do have guns in Canada. They are owned by a lot of people. You know, a lot of the population, especially in rural and northern regions, have guns for hunting and other sort of, you know, purposes that they use in their daily lives.
I think what's also interesting when you talk about culture and societal effects is another very racial aspect to it, if I may bring that up again.
Absolutely.
When you look at who, you know, committed the shootings at Sandy Hook, Columbine, Aurora, they're white men.
Yes.
And there's actually, you know, in terms of...
Same with the shooting in the black church.
Dylan Roof at the historically black church in Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah.
There's interesting, you know, theories, research done, you know, looking at why is it that white men are overrepresented in those who commit mass shootings?
Mm.
And sort of what is being thought to happen is that these are men who have been denied the social, economic, cultural, political capital that they feel entitled to being white men in a society such as America. Even in Canada, when the massacre happened with Polytechnique, you know, I think it was in the suicide notes or remarks made by Mopflepine before, you know, committing the massacre, like he's blaming feminists for not being able to get a job.
Or
you
the
know.
Individual that managed to shoot our RCMP officers a number of years ago, four RCMP officers.
And it's that sense of threat that really, you know, drives them. In having that sort of sense of, you know, grandeur, that drives them to commit not only suicide, but to take others down with them. And, you know, that's sort of a pattern that we've seen, but we don't really talk about that. Because coverage of, you know, these sorts of incidents, the media is, you know, very racialized, targeting Muslims, blacks, etc., where they emphasize the background of people commit crimes in that sense.
Yeah.
But not really for white men. They talk about, well, you know, they had a bad family life, or...
Their,
you know, mental instability, etc.
But also, I mean, the reason I'm bringing this up, just sort of to go back to my point on Canada and comparison, and then if you think of John Oliver, who did a skit, it was a comedy skit, a three-piece, a skit about gun control in the United States versus that in Australia, because after the mass shooting that they had in Port Arthur in the mid-90s, they actually instituted massive reforms in gun controls. And really, I think from what I've read and my interest in this issue, there seems to be a three-pronged approach that must be taken in order to achieve some sort of, you know, successful gun control policy. One, banning and restricting guns and not allowing everybody to buy guns, you know, for absolutely no purpose, especially guns that are, you know, semi-automatic and handguns and other guns that really have no other purpose than to go and shoot at people. Despite what the right wing says about guns being, you know, oh, they don't kill people, it's people that kill people. It's once you put the weapons in the hands of people, they are going to do awful things with them.
Yeah.
The second issue that I'm really looking at, or the second issue that should be addressed with gun control, is race, poverty, because essentially impoverished communities, and which is hand in hand, it goes with race and racialized communities, you know, they have more higher numbers of shootings, and they are affected by gang violence and other sort of type of violence, especially in the United States and pockets like LA, Detroit, other places where these should be addressed. It's poverty and, you know, marginalization and essentially race and society and culture, all these issues, which are complicated and not easy to address. It's not one individual can address it or one government. It's a systemic issue that must be addressed by all levels of government, be it in Canada, the United States, Australia, or any country. The third issue that I really, which I gather from, to summarize your points, Emerson, is essentially health and mental health. Because there seems to be a very significant tie between mental instability and access to guns and sociocultural issues. And these are complicated issues, again, that can't just be addressed overnight. But they must be addressed. And once you address those three issues, you know, simultaneously, you might actually achieve some sort of goal by, you know, in your approach or in your quest to quell violence and restrict gun use and violence. Now, how do we achieve these? I don't think we have that solution, but...
maybe that's a conversation for another copy talk.
Absolutely. But it's something that must be really looked into further. So I encourage all the listeners to go to Emerson's piece and take a look at it, which will be up in the next day or two. I think it will be very useful in understanding how this issue affects society, culture, politics in the United States, and particularly from a historical perspective, which, you know, I am certainly biased. I think historical perspective gives us a more rounded understanding of these issues.
Absolutely.
Rather than just looking at a snapshot
it's
of today's politics.
Sorely lacking in today's discourse.
Absolutely. And the other issues, I think we have a long line or a long conversation that should be had about these issues. And I encourage all our listeners to send in their comments, their feedback. Our email is up on the website. Just to see what your opinions are on these issues.
And on that note, I want to echo what Fadi's saying. We really appreciate the thousands of phone calls and emails that our loyal Coffee Talk listeners are sending to us. It's through the support of loyal listeners such as yourself that you have helped make us, Coffee Talk, the most popular podcast for the Native Association of Canada.
And
we thank you.
From our homes to you, I'd like to thank the participants on this week's program. And for those listening, from us to you, thank you for listening to Coffee Talk. Have a good night.